Detroit Beard Collective is a proud sponsor of Creaking Door Paranormal Radio, powered by SlackJawPunks.com.
Guys, tired of trying to make that burly beard of yours look and smell good? Then check this out. Straight out of the Motor City, where they know a thing or two about being tough, comes Detroit Beard Collective, specializing in making that facial hair look good with products like beard butter, beard oils and soaps, specialty combs, and so much more. Come check out the line today at DetroitBeardCollective.com. DBC takes pride in using Detroit and Michigan-based companies and ingredients in all aspects of their product development and manufacturing as they continue to build Detroit's premier grooming company. Even burly dudes like to look and smell good, and DBC will make that happen. Do yourself and your badass beard a favor and log on to DetroitBeardCollective.com and check out all the amazing products they offer. And when you're ready to check out, use promo code SJPDBC to receive 10% off. Detroit Beard Collective, cleaning this world up one beard at a time.
Welcome back inside Creaking Door Paranormal Radio with Tim Ellis and Brad Blair, and here we are smack dab in the middle of the greatest time of the year. No, we're not talking about December and Christmas. We're talking about right in the middle of the month of October and right around Halloween.
Right, our favorite time of year. Man, what a fall it's been already.
It really has
it's
been.
It's just nonstop travel and just, we love this time of year. We love getting out, talking to people, and being able to hit some of the events. We're just back in from the Chicago Ghost Con.
Yeah.
What a great time.
It really was. And that was one of those ones where it was literally nonstop from the moment we got on the road. We drove to Chicago from the UP here in Michigan and got down there, unpacked, met some of the people of our friends in the bar, and just had a great time Friday night. It was all day Saturday at the event. And then
the after party. Party on Saturday night, and up and back to the event Sunday, and then we hit the road and
drove
a
right
late arrival back home, and bam, just like that.
Yeah, in and out in Chicago, but we had a blast. Want to thank Ursula Bielski for having us in, and she always puts on a fun event there, and it was just great to see everyone and kind of get caught up with everyone again.
It was, and now this coming week, we've got Strange Escapes on Mackinac Island.
Yep.
We'll be heading over to Mackinac Island, Michigan, and meeting up with Amy Bruni and Adam Barry and the whole Strange Escapes crew. Grant Wilson's coming out for this weekend. John Tenney.
Newkirks.
The Newkirks. And it's going to be a blast. So really looking forward to that. And just the nonstop pace of Halloween for people in the paranormal field.
It never fails. As we're heading into it, I always get this little bit of dread. And I'm like, oh, God, this is going to be insane. It's going to be nonstop. There's going to be no rest. But then as soon as you get into it, you're like, all right, you know what? Yeah, I'm tired, but I'm loving every minute of it.
Yeah.
So that's where we are. We're right in the middle of the hubbub that is the month of October because, well, as you know, everyone seems to think that the ghosts and ghost stories only happen this month.
Well, when we were kids, that's when you would see it on TV.
You didn't
have the 24/7 television networks that were carrying these paranormal shows like we have now.
That's right.
Back in my day, kids, it was Halloween time that you'd turn on your TV and see Ed and Lorraine Warren or Hans Holzer on there, and that was it. Maybe 2 to 3 weeks out from Halloween, and then as soon as the month of October was done, you had to wait until the next October.
Exactly. So. It was also back in the days when the only time we could watch our damn cartoons was on Saturday
morning. That's right. I just had this talk with my son this
week. Exactly. And then also after school, we'd get like Bugs Bunny.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, you'd get maybe an hour or so in there.
But yeah, nothing like it is today where it's ghosts all the time and cartoons all the time. Oh, we had it so hard in our day. We actually had to get out of the chair to answer our phone.
We did.
And it didn't walk with you all around the house, although we would stretch that cord.
I can remember getting up from the chair to turn television channels.
Whew.
Things were rough back then, kids.
They
you have
sure
no idea.
Were. Wow. But here we are. Glad to be back in the studio with you inside the creaking door. So we invite you over the next 45 minutes to an hour here to turn the lights down low as we get ready to have some paranormal fun and some spooky fun. Kind of our Halloween edition, although I guess you could really call all of these Halloween edition here in the creaking door.
One way or another.
Yeah, but this one we wanted to kind of, we wanted to pick a topic that was more Halloween related. And that's why coming up a little bit later, we're going to be talking about vampires.
I love it.
Yeah, so that's going to be fun. But before we do any of that, Brad, it is time to dig up the headlines and let's do some paranews. All right, let's jump right into a topic that has actually been in the headlines quite a bit lately, and not necessarily for paranormal reasons or even for good reasons. The NFL has been grabbing headlines left and right lately. Doesn't matter what side of that argument you're on, it's just been everywhere. Well, now it has grabbed some paranormal headline news, and here's why. In a testament to the superstitious nature of sports, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers kicker recently revealed to reporters that he has been consulting with a psychic to improve his game.
What?
Yeah, having returned to the team following a rash of injuries and a brief stint with another organization, Patrick Murray explained that his team in Tampa Bay may prove to be a success thanks to his work with a medium.
Mm-hmm.
There are things she has mentioned that I have told nobody, and there are things that she would have no way of knowing except having powers, he marveled.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the obvious aspect of possibly knowing ahead of time whether or not his kicks will be good, how the psychic helps Murray seems to be more a matter of the mind rather than the way of anything supernatural, though. Maybe it's just getting me to talk that's helped me, he mused, getting stuff off my chest and being able to really kind of feel that positive energy. Unfortunately, the beat writers did not press Murray for any specific insights into the psychic's soothsaying skills or predictions for events yet to unfold. So, one will have to take the kicker at his word that she is a genuine medium. Nonetheless, fans in Tampa Bay may see his surprising consultation as a potential blessing, since a litany of injuries to previous kickers on the team have actually given rise to rumors of some type of curse that has been hanging over the kicker position for Tampa Bay. So, with that in mind, Murray may have stumbled upon the only person who can truly eradicate such a hex. The psychic medium.
Maybe we need to get Chip Coffee to come up here and hang out with the Detroit Lions for a couple of weeks.
Please, Chip. What, come help our Lions.
It looks like they could use it the way this year's going.
Yeah,
so.
And now the Green Bay Packers, too, with
Aaron Rodgers going out. We'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to head out west, and we're going to talk some drunken time travel.
Ooh, sounds like right up our alley.
It does. Police say a central Wyoming man that they arrested for public intoxication claimed he had traveled back in time to warn of an alien invasion. And a little bit of shades of Terminator here, but with a twist to it, I guess. Casper police say the man they encountered claimed he was from the year 2048. KTWQAM.
Are we still going to be alive then?
I doubt it.
What is that?
That's
30-ish.
Yeah. 30 is 48,
roll the dice.
20.
We might
yeah, well, yeah.
Maybe.
I don't know if we'll be alive next week.
If we slow down
for
the drinking, yeah.
KTWQAM in Casper reports that the man told police that he wanted to warn the people of Casper that aliens will arrive next year and that they should leave as soon as possible. He asked to speak to the president of the town, about 170 miles northwest of Cheyenne. The man told police he was only able to time travel because aliens filled his body with alcohol.
Oh,
it must be the
and I are already onto something.
The lube of time travel, if you will.
That means we're already on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
We can time travel.
Lube you up with alcohol and send you down the space-time continuum. So, anyway, yeah, he noted that he was supposed to be transported to the year 2018, not this year, but they miscalculated.
Oh, he overshot.
He overshot
too much
by
alcohol.
A year. So, yeah, that's probably my favorite story to come across the Paranews desk this year.
That one actually went beyond Paranews. That one grabbed national headlines. That trended, actually, on social media. So I love it. What a way. Seriously, this guy, how he thought outside of the box while intoxicated, I give him credit
brilliant.
For that one. Yeah, absolutely brilliant.
Well you're assuming he's not an actual time traveler.
Well, that's
then.
True. Shame on me for saying that. But maybe he is right. And I guess, what do we have to get the DeLorean up to? 78 miles per hour? Is that what it was? And get really drunk, apparently. Mm-hmm. All right, so here's a topic we haven't heard much about lately, the Bermuda Triangle. And all of a sudden, it seems to be grabbing headlines again. A Texas couple traveling to the Bahamas for their honeymoon may be the latest victims of the infamous Bermuda Triangle. At the start of what was to be a week-long trip, Forrest and Donna Seiko flew from the city of Fort Worth in their private plane and landed on the island of Eleuthera, something like that, in the Bahamas on September 25th. It was a refueling stop, the last that anyone had seen of the couple as they departed that airport the next day and headed for the nearby island of Rum Cay, but never arrived at their destination. Unfortunately, their lack of contact with family and friends over the course of the next week did not arouse any suspicion because they were celebrating their recent nuptials in a, well, proverbial paradise, so people weren't too worried about it. It wasn't only until they should have returned back to Fort Worth that their loved ones realized that something was wrong and attempted to track down the couple, but could not find any indication that they had ever even made it to their destination of Rum Cay. When the path of their flight is laid out from their last known stop and where they were heading to, you better believe it lies within the confines of the notorious place known as the Bermuda Triangle. Sadly, the Seikos are the second group of Americans to go missing in the Bermuda Triangle this year, as a similar incident occurred this past May. Bound for Central Florida from Puerto Rico, an aircraft lost contact with air control around 3 hours into the flight and vanished from radar. Aboard the plane were a woman named Jennifer Blumen, her two young sons, and a pilot, Nathan Ulrich. When the flight never arrived in Florida, authorities quickly set about searching for the plane and its passengers, and today, the U.S. Coast Guard and other agencies are still continuing the look for both the plane and its passengers, as well as for answers as to what might have gone wrong during the flight. One possible cause of the incident, inclement weather, has apparently already been ruled out as a possibility, with the Coast Guard saying that there was no indication that such adverse conditions were around when the plane disappeared. But one thing is for sure, the plane did go missing within the infamous Bermuda Triangle. So you don't hear much about it, and then all of a sudden, two planes with Americans go missing this year.
You know, it's such a large area, though, too. If you just look at the math, there has to be logical explanations, you would think.
It seems like it's an atmospheric thing, really.
It does.
Yeah, that why there's so many accidents and lost planes and ships in that area. So maybe someday we'll figure it out. But until then, it's just a big mystery.
One of those great unknowns out there.
So. Or aliens. You can always blame the Grays.
We could blame Slender Man.
Oh, let's do
how about
that.
This next? How about walking out your door and running into the Slender Man?
Nope.
Happening in Oregon right now, folks. Residents in Gresham, Oregon, received a scare after spotting a person impersonating the fictional horror character walking around town. Fox 12 Oregon reported residents witnessed a man walking around town wearing a suit with gloves on his hands and a white mask over the face. Some residents called the police out of fright. Okay. You see heads just turning. People freaked out. He just kept looking at us, Randy Wicht, of Gresham resident, told Fox 12 of Oregon. At that time, I called the non-emergency number for Gresham. Just with everything going on, it really creeped us out. Slender Man, if you're not familiar, started with an online post in 2009 as a mysterious specter whose image people edit into everyday scenes with children at play. He's typically depicted as a spidery figure in a black suit with a featureless white face. This is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, just this time of year, I'm loving it. So anyway, the police confirmed that they received a few calls regarding the sightings of Slender Man and told the man to cut it out. However, the media outlet discovered that the spooky character would be back not just to terrorize the local populace, but for promotions of a local haunted house. Yeah.
Boy, in today's society, though, that's scary. You just never know when someone's going to, you know, be packing.
Right.
And say, defend themselves.
The article goes on to say that the people who own the haunted house that the Slender Man was out promoting had originally thought of putting a sign on him for the location, and that from now on they will be doing that with any characters that they send out into the public.
Wow. Yeah, that's downright creepy. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. That one would freak me out for sure. All right, there we go. That is your paranews for this edition of The Creaking Door. As we get ready to take a break, we're going to straighten things up in here a little bit as we get ready to welcome our next guest back inside The Creaking Door. This will be a return visit for him as we get ready to talk things about vampires.
Right. Yeah.
In honor of Halloween and kind of set the Halloween mood. So let's get ready for that. Turn the lights down low and get ready to get spooked as we come back with Vampires Inside The Creaking Door, powered by SlackJawPunks.com. Love your horror films, comic books, and TV shows served up with a side of what the f***? Then we have the place for you.
Slackjaw Punks!
Yeah, SlackjawPunks.com. We dare you to check them out. A podcast that focuses on all the new horror films, comic books, and TV shows, and interviews with the authors and directors, but covered only the way the guys from
Slackjaw Punks
can do it. Plus, you can enjoy written commentary on all of the new stuff, too, from a whole slew of staff writers. So stop wasting time and check it out.
Slackjaw Punks!
SlackjawPunks.com. Serving it up with a side of what the f***? Welcome back inside Creaking Door Paranormal Radio with Tim Ellis and Brad Blair, and very excited to welcome back inside the Creaking Door. This is his second visit with us. As a matter of fact, almost a year to the date. It was November of 2016 when we first ever had this gentleman inside with us. It's the first time we had ever met him when he joined us a year ago, and we were so impressed, so happy with the show that we had with him. We couldn't wait to have him back in, Brad.
Right.
We were ready to have him back in. So we're very excited to have him in for our Halloween show tonight, because the last time we had him in, we talked everything from Bigfoot to mermaids, fairies, and gnomes. But now we're going to talk about the subject of vampires. So we're very excited to welcome back inside the Creaking Door, Mr. Ron Murphy Jr. Ron, thank you so much for joining us back inside the Creaking Door.
Gentlemen, I'm very flattered to be here. Thanks so much for having me, especially around, you know, for Halloween. This is great. I couldn't ask for more.
Exactly. We love it. We're like little kids. This is like Christmas for most kids. The way excited they get, right, that's how we get for Halloween. So we love this time
that's
of year.
Right.
Yeah. So,
yep. One of my passions for the paranormal is that I can live basically Halloween every single day. So this
yes.
is great.
That's exactly it. Like Brad and I were actually saying in the opening segment of the show, even though we're setting this up as our Halloween show, basically all of our shows are a Halloween,
Halloween
show, you know?
But, that's right. That's
but
right.
Vampires is a topic we don't really touch on a lot. So that's why this is kind of special for us. So, but before we do that, Ron, I really want to kind of jump back a little bit into your past again to really kind of set the path for who you are and how you got to where you are today, because it really is fascinating. You've got, you're quite a studied person when you look at your resume and what you have. You're a student of history, of art history, of literature, of Christianity, and so on and so forth. So let's get a quick history of you and what brought you to where you are today.
Interesting, because what got me started in the paranormal is the radio. And I think it's impossible to think of the paranormal existing outside of the radio or podcast. So without you guys doing this, the world would be a much different place. But whenever I was a kid, you know, we had to listen to terrestrial radio, and that meant, you know, getting a signal from, you know, 50 miles away. That was about it. But I lived outside of Pittsburgh, and there was a station down there, KDKA Radio, which which was the first radio station in America, which is a kind of a cool thing.
It really is.
But
yeah.
About every Saturday would have Stan Gordon. I'm not sure if you gentlemen know him. He's been studying the paranormal. Basically, his claim to fame is the Kecksburg UFO crash. But he's been in this for about 58 years, if you can believe it. I mean, just studying everything from Bigfoot and the unexplained. But they would have him on KDKA radio about monthly, you know, a couple times a month. And he would be talking about these great things like Bigfoot and, you know, aliens. And it would scare the heck out of me. But I would keep on listening. And then the Bigfoot craze of the 70s came about. And I lived in a very small town, two traffic lights, you know, that kind of a town. And pretty soon, he was talking about Bigfoot being seen in my area. Actually, it was reported so much that the news crews were coming up to Blairsville, my hometown, and filming places where this Bigfoot creature was seen. So automatically, you know, I am like, with wide-eyed elementary schoolboy wonder, looking at the world a lot differently. I mean, the news crews that you never see are driving the whole way from Pittsburgh to film my small town. So something must be going on. And my mother really fueled my passion for this as well, too, because every time there was a Bigfoot report, she would load my brother and I up in the car, and we would go investigating ourselves. So, I mean, from a very nice. Young age, I had this knowledge that there was something out there beyond comprehension, let's put it that way. And then I eventually, you know, went to high school, and, you know, Bigfoot wasn't so popular, and I had to kind of keep quiet. But then I went to the University of Pittsburgh, and I was studying literature, and I was studying history at the time down there as well. And all of a sudden, the world of Bigfoot, you know, reappeared to me. Now textbooks were talking about the possibility of a man-like creature living into historical existence, possibly being the archetype for the Yeti. And, you know, the literature that I was reading, like about Grendel and about Enkidu from Beowulf, all these great works of literature is now talking about these hair-covered bipedal creatures. So I took my love, my early love, my childhood love for the unexplained, and I basically look at all these creatures, these things that go bump the night, as archetypes. And I try to get to the bottom of it historically, culturally, psychologically. What is going on? Why do we need these creatures? And we need these creatures as much as they need us. And there's a reason behind that. I've kind of found my little niche right now in the paranormal field by investigating these kind of creatures from a point of view that is all-encompassing. You know, it's a human thought. It's, you know, what Carl Jung would call a collective unconscious. And I'm really trying to figure out why we have these creatures, what do they mean to us, and what's so exciting about this is as I study history and as I study the arts and I study the literature, it seems to me that there is indeed a creature responsible for these archetypes. It may have existed back in the dim past, but it's so impacted who we are as a species. We carry that memory with us today.
Right. And you've got so many books out on so many different aspects of the paranormal, Ron. You've got your books on Dogman, on ghosts, mermaids, and what we have you on tonight to talk a little bit about, and that is on vampires.
Yeah, and I'm very proud of this book, as a matter of fact. It was released not very long ago, as a matter of fact, in the summer. I think it was released right around June. I was very fortunate to have Jonathan Downs for the Center of Fortean Zoology over in England actually publish this one. And, I'm very, very happy with the way it turned out. But, again, I start all my books out as early as I can go back. And as usually, you know, the Paleolithic, whenever mankind was struggling with the forces of nature around him just to survive. And I found some compelling evidence in the archaeological record that shows what we would call a vampire actually honestly existing. You know, we're not talking about the Bela Lugosi, we're not talking about the stake through the heart. But what we are talking about is a cave in the Cheddar Gorge area of England, same place where the cheese is made. And this particular cave is called Goes Cave. And then in that cave, there was the archaeological recovery of human bones. There was three individuals of various ages, but two of them were quite young, and one of them was adolescent. And these bones were found right alongside animal bones. So they were processed for food just as the animals were within this cave as well, too, by humans, by other humans that were feeding upon other humans, because the Ice Age was a very difficult time to find food. So any food was available that it would have been consumed. But what was so interesting about this site is they found the skulls of these individuals that were killed fashioned into goblets. And inside this kind of horrific type of drinking cup was found the remains of human blood. So the inhabitants of that cave were not only killing fellow human beings, they were also ingesting the blood. So when we talk about the idea of a collective unconscious, think about the kind of statement that would make in the psyche of early man. I mean, this is something that would really definitely stick with us. And no wonder we have movies about vampires today, because I'm sure that haunted us throughout our formative years as a species.
So at what point then in your research, Ron, did you find when the first written text of folklore, or even if it was not even necessarily in story form, but actual text of people believing that there could be these type of creatures?
Yeah, see, that's an excellent question. You're looking for some sort of definitive evidence that people are now coalescing the mythos of the vampire into something that everybody can relate to within a particular culture.
Right.
And that is an excellent way to look at things. That's the way I write as well, too. And we can go back right into the age of Babylon when we have the goddess Lilith, which was a feared figure. It was a female figure. It was winged. Some of her attributes were killing children. There were sacrifices made to her involving the sacrifice of children very on within her cult. But we see hints of Lilith in Babylon to the point that if you go to Pennsylvania University at the museum, they actually have incantations and amulets from that particular time period, going back about 2,500 years. Oh, I'm sorry, about 2,500 BC. So we're looking almost 5,000 years ago. These amulets and these charms that were placed in people's houses to ward this spirit of Lilith out of the house, because it was believed that she would sneak into the house and kill the children. Now, why is this? Well, we have to look at the Jewish record for this, because there is the oral tradition of the Jewish people that has actually been written down after a time, that Eve was actually the second wife of Adam, and the first wife of Adam was Lilith, and she was created from the dust the same as Adam was. So she was consubstantial with Adam. She was not made from him, so she was on the same playing field. And as it happened, Adam wanted to be superior to his wife, and she would not have any of it. She would not allow this, and so she was thrown out of Eve. Eden, and then Eve was created to be more subservient to her husband. So we have this very strong female figure that goes out into the wastelands around Eden and meets none other than Satan himself, the fallen angel, and they copulate, and they have these children. And now in the Muslim tradition, the children that she has with Satan is the jinn, these kind of spiritual beings that go about the world haunting people, sometimes reanimating freshly buried corpses and coming back from the dead. So you can see all these different elements shaping the vampire that we can recognize today. But to take her revenge out on humankind because she was thrown out of Eden, it was believed in these Jewish texts that she would kill the children of Adam and Eve. And if you think about it, in a pre-scientific culture, if a child is found dead without any kind of further, you know, any antecedent to it, there has to be some sort of explanation. So the easy explanation was that an evil spirit came in and took this child's life. Now, I know that we're jumping all over the place here, mm-hmm. going from this particular area, but the Egyptians believed in a similar type of vampiric creature that would come in the night and kill the children as well. And this is probably the first incident that you find garlic being used to keep away these evil creatures, because one of the ways that the Egyptians would stimulate nursing, breastfeeding, was to take garlic and put it around the female breast so the baby would latch on. So isn't it interesting to see how all this stuff comes into play? You know, something that happened 5,000 years ago, bits and pieces of now still exist within the vampire legend. But if you want to know whenever, you know, there was written accounts, you can find it in Babylon. You can find it in the Jewish text. You can find it in the Egyptian text. So we're looking at somewhere probably right around 5,000 years ago, we have actual written accounts of vampiric activity.
Oh, yeah, and I've always found it interesting how the vampire morphs throughout the years. You know, unlike other creatures of superstition, it seems the vampire evolves into whatever society of that time might reflect. It's never been one. I know back in the 1700s, 1800s, it was this restless, rotting corpse. But nowadays, it's a pop icon.
It is. And that's a great way to look at it. And that's how my books are set up, too, by the way, is that it examines the way each culture throughout time and space visualizes this creature. So when we think of the Strigoi from Eastern Europe, this kind of, like you said, this reanimated, rotting corpse that goes around, you know, sucking human blood for sustenance, compare that with the sparkling vampires of Twilight, you know. Yeah, I mean, that is the thing. Now, why is that? And I've included the chapter in my book because, you know, these are not the vampires that I grew up on. You know, I grew up with on the Hammer films. You know, these
yes,
vampires meant business.
Absolutely.
You know, they would easily seduce the women and the villages and everything. But these were things that you feared. You know, I'm not really afraid of a sparkling creature of any kind. But there are some, you know, scholars that suggest that we are in a world that seems to be far worse than we're doing more damage to each other than a vampire ever could, you know. So these are creatures that we see as, you know, somehow blamed for actions that we are doing, but we're blaming the other for it. And I guess if you look at through that particular lens, things start making sense. You know, these are creatures that are misunderstood, and they have a hope for redemption, something that we might not have. So the roles are kind of reverse. We are the monsters now, and these vampire creatures are the ones that are the suffering of within the you know, human context.
Well, and I agree with you too, Ron. You know, Brad and I also grew up with the Hammer film versions and absolutely loved them. Much scarier than Universal's version, but Universal was still great too.
Well, that was groundbreaking,
right? Absolutely,
Universal. Nobody had done them yet,
right? You know, but even I think we got to bring it back to Bram Stoker, who, if we're going to blame anyone for making the vampire more pretty, and then it's just kind of gone downhill from there, it's got to be Bram, because Bram is the one who really kind of made the character, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe he's the one who made him a seducing character. Before it was written, anything that had to do with a vampire was, as Brad had alluded to, dark, evil. Just killed children, came into your house at night. Now all of a sudden he's coming into your house at night. But even the seducing of the woman was always beautiful. And a lot of Freudians will say that even the biting of the neck was a sexual form of taking the woman. So, you know, it's just, I think Bram Stoker really is the one who changed the face of the vampire.
He did. You know, and he also was involved with the theater, so he knew how this would all interact on a global scale. So you could close your eyes, and you can really visualize what Stoker put down on paper. But if you go back about 25 years prior to Bram Stoker, you have a French writer by the name of Fanu who writes this. It's not great by any sense of the imagination, but it is a novel called Camilla or Carmilla, which is about a female vampire that sets her sights on another woman. So this, within this lesbian context, you have this seducing vampire, this very beautiful female vampire seducing another woman. Of course, Stoker and Fanu were going against the Victorian mores. You know, they were kind of turning the world upside down. But of course, the sexual elements were very, very important. But again, I whenever anybody asks me about this, if you go back to the very beginning and look at the Lilith mythos, there is sexuality involved in that as well, too, because, as I said, you know, to make it more polite, one of the reasons why she was thrown out of Eden is because she wanted to assume a more dominant position in the sexual exploits of Adam, but he would have none of that. So we have a very powerful, sexually energized figure that is breaking onto the world scene, and it's really turning the idea of what a man is upside down. And that's what Fanu did, you know, prior to Bram Stoker. But of course, you know, he continues this other tradition, this Eastern European tradition. But I recommend anybody that has an interest to see the other side of the vampire mythos developing and look at Fanu's Carmilla. And actually, I think, if I'm not mistaken, and I know that I'm probably not mistaken on this, that there was a web series called Carmilla that is actually based upon this book. And I heard that it was Canadian and fairly well done. So, I mean, there is some things out there that you can look at, you know, instead of reading this, because it was serialized and it really doesn't read well. You know, even though it's, you know, not even 200 years old yet, it doesn't read, you know, all that well. But I'll tell you, Bram Stoker's Dracula still stands up. I don't know if you gentlemen have read it, but, you know, it still has weight to it.
Well, and I think if you ask most people nowadays where the vampire legend comes from, I think kids nowadays especially would probably bring up Dracula. I don't know that they realize that this goes back further, mm-hmm. or that, you know, Bram Stoker took an actual historical figure and based his character off of that, like as he did with Vlad Tepes for Dracula. I don't know that the Dracula mythology, as you're telling us right now, Ron, really gets into this younger generation.
It does not, and, you know, it would be nice if somebody would sit down, some Hollywood professional would sit down and say, let us make a true-to-life werewolf film or a true-to-life vampire film and really explore these dark recesses of the mind and really kind of relate it to the collective unconscious and the idea of the id, you know, in control and everything. It would be a far different landscape in which we set these particular archetypal creatures. But, of course, you know, they don't want to do that. They want things that are marketable. Mm-hmm. But I think that whenever we really get to the heart of the matter, these things are much more terrifying than what we see on the screen, because there's a deep darkness to them that really cannot be related in any other way than examining them from a psychological perspective.
And what's interesting is when you think of the character Dracula and what Bram Stoker did with it is he really took two different entities and brought it together. As Brad said, it's based on Vlad Tepes, but it's also based on the vampire lore, which the two in itself were different, but he brought them together to create this one thing that, as we just stated, most kids today think that's where vampires itself started, because of Dracula.
That's right, as if he was
the first.
If he was the first one.
You yeah.
know, the genesis of the vampire began with a character of Dracula, of Vlad Tepes, you know, and that's nowhere near the case. By the time Vlad comes onto the scene, the idea of vampires in Eastern Europe was already right around that area, about 3,000 years old by the time it migrated from other places. But, you know, again, even America American Indians, you know, the First Nations peoples in Africa, across the world, every culture has an idea of something that comes out at night, will steal into your room, and will take your life if you're not wary. So because it is so prevalent in every culture, you have to really discuss why that is. You know, why is there so many similarities between something the Australian Aborigines would hold close, you know, would huddle around at night fearing, and the same thing that would be discussed in the French Alps. You know, how does that happen? And we really have to go back and, you know, dust off the pages of time and go as deep as we possibly can to find out that, you know, something obviously had happened and, you know, we confronted it. It really kind of left its imprint on our psyche, and now we are trying to work it out, you know, 5, 6, 7,000 years later within our own time.
Yeah, and it keeps changing, and it keeps evolving, and it seems every generation or two has a different model of the vampires, especially in pop culture, like we've been talking about Dracula here, and then in the, I guess, our generation, when Tim and I were growing up or high school age or so, is when Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles got into our hands,
right.
And you've got the vampire Lestat, and all of a sudden you've got this poor creature that you feel sympathy towards, you know, him and Louis and Anne Rice's characters, and they become kind of superheroes in her writing, and I think at least that was the first book series that I ever read where the vampire all of a sudden becomes more of the protagonist.
That's right. They become tragic figures, don't they?
I
mean, that's what's
Absolutely.
Going on. These are basically good people, and they have this life thrust upon them. And the challenge they have to make is what they're going to do with this life. You know, are they going to continue as damned creatures? Or are they going to try to make some sort of recompense and be, you know, seek their salvation somehow? And that's very interesting as well, too. And that's another thing that we had never seen before. We could actually sympathize with these creatures, these terrible creatures that would quickly rip out your throat. You begin to sympathize with them. And I agree. I think Anne Rice did a great job with them. And she was really, she was starting a new trend. She was still dealing with a lot of the themes that we had seen in the past, but she took it a different angle. And I think for our generation, as you said, I think that is more meaningful than what the kids have to put up today with things like Twilight, because we really examined the vampire differently at that point.
But I think now that we're sitting here talking about this and putting it on the table, though, I think maybe we almost have to yell at Anne Rice a little bit, because maybe she's the one who softened us to the vampire and paved the way to Twilight and creating the superhero.
The Vampire Diaries, and you've got all of these teen tween vampire heroes, and yeah, I think
Interview with the Vampire was the first step in softening the vampire, if you will.
Yeah, I think I think the first step in humanizing the vampire definitely comes from that. But we have to remember, though, that even in Bram Stoker's book, at the very end of the book, he still seeks that salvation for his character.
Right.
Mina still. So there's always that drive to think that there is something good that come out of such an evil type of creature. Mm-hmm. And you know what? That also says something about who we are as human beings. Because as terrible of a species as we can be to our fellow man, there is still something within us that wants to save our fellow man as well, too. You know, we're a dichotomy in and of itself. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I like to study this stuff so much with Bigfoot. You know, the idea that there's a wild man out there outside of our civilization. What does that mean? Or, you know, mermaids, something that is human-like, but it lives, you know, beyond our rationale. These are the kind of things that gives me this passion, that keeps me going, that makes me want to write. And I find my books that I write very enjoyable. It's not like a terrible or a tedious job that I have. I find them enjoyable because I learn something every time I pick up, you know, a book to start investigating.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I found fascinating, Ron, is, you know, when you take folklore and the legends or the actual beliefs that these generations had, and then what made it into Hollywood. Of course, we know the stake through the heart to kill the vampire comes from the belief that you have to stick him to the ground so he doesn't get out of the grave, if they believed he was a vampire. One that I always found really interesting, and I've never seen any movie version of it grab. And did you ever come across anything like this, or ever come across any type of tradition that never made it to Hollywood? But the one that I always found interesting was they used to take like a rock and shove it within the jaw of the vampire, the person they believed to be a vampire, so that they believed that they couldn't use their mouth anymore if they got out of the grave. Come across anything like that?
As if they could not take it out by
yeah,
their hands.
Well, exactly.
I always found that kind of comical, you know?
Right.
There are graves throughout the world that have this particular burial where the rock is shoved into the mouth. We find these cases in Poland. We find these things in Italy. And we even have cases in England that involves these kind of actions. Now, one thing that a lot of people had practiced was the exhumation of the body, the cutting out of the human heart, the vampire's heart, making it or burning it and taking the ashes and putting it into a liquid to ingest to keep you safe from the vampire. Now, the last case that had happened, well, that was reported to have happened, was in 2005 in Romania. So, you know, we're talking only about 12 years ago that there was a report that this happened. Now, that's, you know, notwithstanding that this is happening and not being reported, because I'm sure that it does. But I will tell you this. There was a vampire scare in New England. There was vampires being reported in Connecticut, and there was vampires being reported in Rhode Island and Maine. What was going on is tuberculosis was spreading. And this is, you know, the idea of consumption. Something was seemingly consuming an otherwise healthy person, and something seems to have, you know, really took hold and started to decimate this person. So as tuberculosis swept throughout New England, people automatically assumed that there was a vampire out there. There was one family called the Brown family that started to lose members of its family. And then the daughter died. Her name was Mercy Brown. She was interred, but then her brother got sick. So the family automatically thinks, oh, geez, you know, Mercy is rising out of the grave to feed upon the family. So they rushed off like any good parent would do, with a shovel, dug up the daughter. As they opened up her chest cavity, they found out that indeed her heart still had traces of human blood in it. So they ripped her heart out. They burnt it. They put it into a mixture. They took the mixture and put it in water and had her brother, who was in the throes of consumption, drink it. Now, he eventually did die. But what I wanted to illustrate by this particular tale is that this happened in 1892, which blows my mind. My great-grandmother was born in 1890. To put this in perspective, professional baseball was already about 30 years old by this time. In 1892, basketball was invented. Professional football was now being played. It blows your mind to think that people were still doing such a thing well after the Civil War. I mean, we are approaching the end of the Victorian age in a place in New England that, you know, if you think about the great colleges and universities that are up there. So these people were not, you know, yokels someplace. These people thought genuinely that there was a vampire on the loose. They wanted to save their family.
Wow. Yeah, when you put it in that type of context, when you lay it out like that, it's really devastating to think that people are going to professional sporting events, which we still have today, and there's a family out there that's utilizing those methods.
Yeah,
that's...
Not just any family. That's the other thing, too.
Right.
That there was a lot of this stuff going on. There's a vampire graveyard, actually, in Connecticut. The whole family, of course, did have tuberculosis, but they were all buried. The head was chopped off, and that skull, that, you know, the crossbones were all found, too, where they severed off the arms and legs so the thing could not get up and take its revenge. So we find this happening throughout Connecticut, the whole way up into Maine.
Oh, my goodness. So right now, Ron Murphy Jr., author, amazing author, is our guest, talking and sharing creepy stories about vampires. And Ron, we'll let you go here in just a moment, but I want to run one more thing by you, because it's a part of the vampire lore we haven't quite touched on, and you don't hear a lot about it. Again, another thing that Hollywood hasn't really grabbed and touched on too much, although they did kind of hit it in the Twilight thing where they had kind of a, I think, a hybrid werewolf vampire baby born. But what about offspring of vampires? I know there's some Bulgarian folklore about it, that the husband could come back as a vampire and impregnate his wife, and then they could have an offspring. Did you come across anything like that in your research?
I did. Like I said, there's a sexual mystique that surrounds the vampire, even the biting on the neck. The idea that there can be a transmission of something deadly onto an unwary person is synonymous with not only the vampire, but also with the werewolf, because it basically creeps up to you and takes control over you against your will. That's something that's very scary to the human race. You know, that's scary that something can come in, and even though you say you're prayers by night, something can still make you evil. And the idea that your offspring could indeed be of an evil nature is very, very prominent in a lot of these vampire legends. So whenever we think of things like the incubus or the succubus, these are, within the tradition, part of the vampire legend, that something can come and take your life force or infect you mm-hmm. with its life force to make something far different. It's counter to the creation. You know, it's counter to the way things work. Things are upside down by this way. But yes, that is definitely a part of it. That, you know, the unwary can be taken advantage of and produce something that is so vile and evil that it's against human imagination.
Yeah.
So we're seeing vampires nowadays sparkling. We're seeing them as sex objects, Ron. Where do they go to next?
Vampires in outer space, right?
Yeah. I am thinking, and I did investigate this a lot in my book, because I was, I was fascinated by it. But there's a new age element to a lot of these vampires, that they do not feed off of human beings, but they feed off of the natural world around them. Sometimes they have to go out into thunderstorms and lightning storms and feed off of the very energy. Now, of course, we have the idea of psychic vampires that feeds off the mental life forces of people. You know, there are still some sanguine vampires out there. I met, I had to dip my toes into the fetish world, if you will, and it's not a place I really could spend a lot of time in, but there are people out there that consider themselves hosts for vampires, and there are people out there that do consider themselves as vampires, and you can go and put an ad up on various sites and meet somebody that wants you to drink their blood. If you wanted to, you could probably have that done tonight. You know, that's kind of a kinky thing, I suppose, for some people. Really not up my alley, but there's people out there that love this kind of stuff. So I think what's going to happen next is that it's going to be either more nature-based or much more sexually charged, to the point that it becomes, you know, one of these kinky fetishes and clubs open. But, you know, that's really not looking into the future, because there are indeed vampire clubs all over the world.
Right.
There's even one in Japan. So I think but that's role-playing, though. That's a fantasy mm-hmm. that the participants are entering into. But I think that you're going to see a new age element coming into it, where people are saying they're vampires because they have this. They're in tune with the world around them, and in order to live, they have to feed off of the natural environment.
Absolutely fascinating stuff as we head into this Halloween season. Wear your garlic, keep your crucifixes close, and beware of the vampires. Ron Murphy Jr. Ron, real quick, where is the best place for people to find your books? You have amazing books out there, so many different titles, so many different subject matters. Where's the best place to find them? I found most years at Amazon. Is there any other place other than Amazon?
Amazon Amazon is like the end-all and be-all. That's right, the right. easiest place to go. Yeah, you can go to ronaldmurphy.org, and you can find some things on there as well, too. But you know what? It's not going to be as inexpensive as it is going to be on Amazon, because the publisher just simply puts it up there themselves, and that's the best price you're going to get, and you can usually get free shipping. So if you want the book, you're going to be able to find the best prices on Amazon. That's just the way the world works, gentlemen.
It really is, and with Amazon Prime, you can't beat that. That's for sure. So
you cannot beat that. That's correct. But I would urge people to buy the actual Honest to Goodness book.
Yes.
A lot of people buy the electronic version, which I could never get into, but I know there's a lot of people on the go. But, you know, if you buy the electronic book, you're really missing out on a lot of the photographs and a lot of the other, you know, kind of things that are added on towards the end. So I recommend anybody just buying the book version. It's so much better.
Yeah, Brad and I are firm supporters of the actual book in hand.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Hearing that bind crack when you open it up. There's nothing like it. So love that stuff.
It becomes your friend. You're spending
so much time
with the book.
Very true.
That Absolutely. It becomes your friend after a while.
And it probably spends way too much bathroom time with you too that it shouldn't. But it is what it is, you know. Ron Murphy
That's
Jr.
What I'm talking about.
Thank you so much, my friend, for coming back inside the Creaking Door with us. We had an absolute blast once again, just talking wonderful legends and folklore, and this time all about family. Empires. Thanks for being with us, Ron.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me, guys. We'll see you soon.
You betcha. We're going to take a break. When we come back, more on the way. This is Creaking Door Paranormal Radio, powered by SlackJawPunks.com. Nestled inside historic Old Village in Plymouth, Michigan, sits a beer lover's destination, Liberty Street Brewing Company. Since 2008, Liberty Street Brewing Company has been crafting delicious beer the right way, brewed in small amounts to ensure quality and maintain freshness. The moment you walk in, your experience is their number one concern. Caring staff, updated and changing list of delicious beer, and a short list of regular food are all waiting for you. Once you walk in, you won't want to leave. Or grab a growler of your favorite Liberty Street Brewing Company beer and head home to enjoy the latest episode of Creaking Door Paranormal Radio. Liberty Brewing Company in Plymouth, Michigan, giving you the freedom to choose a better beer. Welcome back inside Creaking Door Paranormal Radio with Tim Ellis and Brad Blair, where creepy is cool. And
yes.
Talking about vampires is downright cool. That was so much fun having
Ron, he's so insightful on so many topics, and I got a chance to actually sit down and talk one-on-one with him at CryptidCon this mm-hmm. year, and just a genuine, nice guy, but the stuff that he gets into.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just every aspect. He's called the crypto guru for a reason.
Yeah, the guy knows something about everything.
Right.
And when you sit down and talk with him, you get that. You
really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. You really appreciate the depth that he puts into his research.
Absolutely. So it was great having Ron back in and just talking vampires and just kind of having fun on this Halloween episode of Creaking Door Paranormal Radio. And right now we want to do a segment we like to call Mailbag, where we invite any of our listeners to submit a question or just a comment or something you want to share with us. Find us on Facebook. We're the only Creaking Door Paranormal Radio on Facebook, and you can submit a private message to us there or leave it on the actual page, and we are happy to use them and answer any questions we can and have it be part of the show if you would like them to as well. Like this one, our mailbag question today comes from Sherry from one of the our favorite cities, Brad, New Orleans.
Love it.
Love New Orleans, and just seemed fitting for this time of year as well.
It does.
Says, hello, Tim and Brad. Longtime listener, never miss an episode. I found out about your show quite a while ago when Amy Bruni shared a post about being on your show. I've been a fan ever since. Also, I saw you two speak in Chicago.
Oh.
Just a week ago. Great job. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Sherry. We do appreciate that. Okay, she says, okay, pretty easy question here, fellas, but would love your take on it. What is your thought on Ouija? Is the Ouija dangerous? I know my feelings on it, but very interested in yours. I listen to your show when it comes out, and I respect both of your very practical, I like what she says there, very practical take on the paranormal. I know you've had shows on the topic. Yeah, I guess. I know you've had shows on the topic, but don't know if you've ever really said what your personal take is on it. Keep up the good work. So, Sherry, thank you for the mailbag question. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Ouija was really hand-in-hand with my upbringing getting into the paranormal. Mm-hmm. I know outside of us checking out books, heading to the library, and reading up on everything, and for practical one-on-one actual paranormal research, I can trace it back to high school and doing seances with the Ouija board.
Yep, absolutely. And Brad and I did it with our group of friends growing up. We have one particular story about Devil's Night in a cemetery
that involved a Ouija board.
Now, you know, I really think, at least my journey, and I think our journeys are pretty similar with the Ouija board, Brad, that it's kind of evolved. When we were kids, we had a lot of fun with it. Brad and I went to church school together. Our church school teacher, oh my goodness, did she reprimand us. She would lecture us right in front of the class for using the Ouija board.
We were the black sheep of the church school.
Yeah, so. We were, because we were the ones running around looking for ghosts and running around through graveyards and using the Ouija, and she would knew about it, and she would lecture us right in front of the class, and we'd be smirking at each other. And so we kind of went through that phase, and then I think we kind of fell out of it for a while.
Well, I think when it comes down to it, it's hard. You get that many people involved, even if it's just two people and you've got your hands on, it's hard to prove. You really can't prove that neither is pushing it or whatever. So when I think I know where you're going with this, Tim. When we got more into the serious side of paranormal research, we just kind of went by the wayside.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it had to be, because there's nothing... It's manipulated way too easy. And obviously some of the other equipment we use in the field of investigating is too. But now to answer the question, is it dangerous? And the bottom line is, it's no more dangerous than any other tool you use to communicate in the field. It's no different than trying to do an EVP session. If you're trying to talk to a spirit, if you're trying to communicate to the other side, the Ouija does the same thing as an EVP session.
Right, I agree. And anybody breaking out an Ovilus or you know, these different programs,
Frank's box.
Yeah, it's you're doing the same thing. Now, granted, with the Ouija, you're asking it to come through your body and channel the energy directly. But you're opening a door. Mm-hmm. You're opening a door, and you're doing that in almost every aspect of paranormal research.
Right.
So I agree with Tim on it. I don't think it's any more dangerous than any of these other facets in the field. In fact, a few weeks ago, I had the chance to do a Ouija seance with Mr. Ouija himself, Robert Murch.
That's pretty dang cool.
Over at Sage Paracon in England, and what a great time. And I'll tell you, throughout the night, and we were in Warwick Castle, which is this old medieval British castle, amazing setting. And we got to investigate different areas of the castle. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there was any other point in the night where I saw everybody just clam up and concentrate on what was going on as when we were doing the Ouija with Murch.
Yeah.
It was such a great feeling.
Murch, I mean, that's...
It was amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It was a lot of fun. I was not concerned about getting possessed.
Right.
What did
happen that night? Actually, you and I, we haven't had a chance to even talk about that particular part of the event.
This was in a room, in a bedroom in the castle, where Aleister Crowley had held seances in the past.
Wow, that just gave me chills.
We were trying to make some contact there. I'd led an EVP session right before this, and then we broke out the boards, and there was some activity going on the board, not while I was on it, naturally,
but
there were a couple of young ladies that got on it, and one was psychic, and they were getting some answers through. I did not find out if they went back and researched to see if any of the answers made sense to anybody with knowledge of the castle. But it was cool. It was nostalgic, for one.
Yeah.
It really brought back the old days of doing this. And I was only on it for a couple of minutes, and I stepped back and let everybody else that was there
But just to say, you were on a Ouija board in a room where Aleister Crowley
conducted seances was, yeah.
What about the EVP session? Anything?
There was actually, there were a couple of things. They were so faint, I couldn't really make them out. But while we were doing it, there was kind of a scratching and moaning coming from the back corner at one point. Wow.
Do you still have the audio from
it? I do. I have to download that.
I want to get that on our audio equipment.
Yeah, like I say, just with all the travel lately, we're still playing catch up.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was great.
Well, you're actually sounding
better
now, too.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of came back with the plague, and I was just happy at Chicago Ghost Con I could actually get through our hour lecture without my voice cracking or me going into a convulsion of coughing.
Yeah. So, Sherry, great question.
Thanks, Sherry.
Again, it really is it is what you use it for. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if you're going to use it for a tool to communicate with the dead, then you better be prepared what could happen.
Right.
If you're going to use it for a pop culture piece of art, which, let's be honest, it's becoming pop culture again.
Oh, big time.
I mean, the Ouija is everywhere.
I just got a 1915 board. Just showed up in the mail last week
that
I picked up on an online auction house. So, yeah.
Yeah, so that brings me to something here, Bradley. I want to get this to you.
Nice decor it is. So,
give you some more decor.
What are you digging into here?
My wife and I were out Halloween shopping a while ago, and we came across this. We bought ourselves the same one, and we saw it, and we wanted to get it for you and your wife. It is a Ouija board wine and cheese tray.
Oh my.
Yes.
Good loaded,
and
good
so
loaded.
It's
thank you.
It says
that.
Cheese and spirits up top. Yes and
wow.
No.
Wow.
So
thank
there you. Go.
That is so freaking cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to get a picture of this and put it up on the page. This is
it's really cool.
This is going right in the living room. So
we've got it on our kitchen table. And then we came across this. And thought this
no, leave the porn in there, Tim.
Oh, all
that's
right.
Early.
Because I have the same copy that I found, and we happen to come across another one, an LP of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, the actual broadcast.
It's like my
Christmas
birthday
morning.
And Christmas wrapped all
so
in one.
There you go. Happy Halloween.
Awesome. God, and I didn't bring you anything.
That's quite all right. Buy me some beer. We'll call it good.
Sounds good.
There you go. All right. That is going to do it, I believe. Do we have any other announcements we need to get out there? Halloween, we've got
Halloween,
a
we
big
will,
announcement.
We will once again be joining up with our regular paranormal research team, the UP Paranormal Research Society, and I believe we are once again doing a live on-air investigation.
We are.
And we will put details of that up on our social media sites. Follow us on Twitter and the Facebook if you're not already.
We do the tweeting.
And also we're kicking into high gear starting to book for next year's 2018's Michigan Paranormal Convention.
Yes.
Which will be held once again at Kuwaitin Casino in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, from August 23rd through 25th, I believe, are the dates for next year.
Yep.
Already signed, Grant Wilson from Ghost Hunters, Nick Groff and Katrina Weedman from Paranormal Lockdown, and Jeff Mudgett. Glad to have Jeff back this
Very
year
nice.
on the tale of his highly popular History Channel show, American Ripper. So, and we will on Halloween be announcing both on our live presentation, our live ghost hunt that we're going to be on, as well as on our social media sites, the next additions to the lineup for the 2018 Michigan Paracon.
Yes, so lots of stuff coming up here over the next couple of weeks, so be watching us on social media. All right, that is going to do it for another episode of Creaking Door Paranormal Radio. On behalf of my co-host Brad Blair and the producers behind the scenes making this show happen, thank you for tuning in to Creaking Door Paranormal Radio, powered by SlackJawPunks.com, and wishing everyone a very happy and safe Halloween.
The Creaking Door.